The sermon today is a sort of a continuation of the sermon I gave last time, and the title of this sermon is Satan's Continual Attack on the Family of Man. We spoke last time of Satan, why he continues to deceive mankind, and why he spends a great deal of effort in causing discord and confusion and division, even among the people of God. We discussed the wisdom of this world and its origin, and we also spoke of the wisdom which comes down from above, which wisdom we heard about in the sermonette, which comes through God's Spirit and from God to us as a special gift, in addition to God's Spirit. Because through that Spirit, we're able to understand this wisdom which comes down from above. And we spoke of the positive attributes of this wisdom from above, which is first pure in that it's not self-seeking. And it's peaceable. There's no spirit of competition in it. It's gentle and considerate of others. It's willing to yield. Easy to be entreated, submissive. It's full of mercy and goodness, and ready. I was just looking, something was going on in the back. It's all right, I'm sorry, I apologize. Full of mercy and goodness. It's ready to help even when the other party may be in the wrong. And it is without partiality. It doesn't favor one over another. And finally, it is without hypocrisy. It doesn't pretend to be something that it is not. And we noted that God equates this wisdom with righteousness, which is the ultimate result which one gets when he walks in this wisdom from above. Jesus stated in the book of, James stated in the book that he wrote, the book of James, chapter 4 and verse 4, that you cannot be a friend of this world and at the same time be a friend of God. Now, why is that? Because a friend of the world will adopt the standards of this world, which he will then live by. While a friend of God will choose to live by the standards which God has established. The result of mankind living by the standards of this world are, of course, division and confusion and war. When you look around you, as we heard in the announcements, you're able to see this every day. And so once we, and the wars, yes, we have wars between nations, but the wars begin in the mind of individuals. And so it's possible for any of us to get caught up with that attitude. But once we're called of God, we're admonished to flee Satan and his ways and to draw close to God. Yet we understand that a large majority of mankind has been tricked into believing Satan. And even after one is called of God, he is not free of Satan's devices. Notice what was prophesied to happen to some after they began following God and his way. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. And we read now, it says, now the Spirit expressly says that in latter times some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron, and forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from foods which were created by God to be received with thanksgiving. What is this speaking of, brethren? It's speaking of leaders in the church who have departed from the faith. And they are, according to all the footnotes that I have seen on several commentaries, they are lying religious leaders and false ministers who are teaching half-truths. And they are leading unsuspecting members into error and causing them to depart from the faith once delivered as they speak their lies in hypocrisy. Satan will use whomever he will, brethren, to cause God's people to turn from truth, because he despises this way to which you and I have been called. And these doctrines which these men use to deceive, Paul says, are of deceiving spirits and are the doctrines of demons. And these ministers are unfaithful in teaching the truth. And in the case noted here, particularly concerning marriage and foods, they attempt to deceive individuals who already know the truth. And many who are weak in the faith are tragically deceived. Now, Satan is the author of confusion and of deception, whether it is overt or covert. Many of God's people have been tricked into leaving God's truth by Satan's tactics. And we know about Satan, brethren. We know that he is a liar. We read this back in the book of John. John chapter 8 and verse 44. Says, "You are of your father the devil." Jesus was speaking to these people. And he says, "The desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. And when he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it." Thus, deception comes easy for Satan and for those who follow in Satan's ways. Notice Paul's admonition to the Colossians. Look at Colossians chapter 2. Colossians 2, verses 20 through 23. "Therefore, if you died with Christ from the basic principles of the world, why, as though living in the world, do you subject yourselves to regulations?" These were people that were going back into the world and beginning to do things that they had come out of. Talking about touch not and taste not and handle not, which all concern things which perish with the using, according to the commandments and doctrines of men. These things indeed have an appearance of wisdom in self-imposed religion and false humility and neglect of the body, but are of no value against the indulgence of the flesh. They were trying to purify the spirit by punishing the body. And this was in accordance with the philosophies of this world, brethren. Paul said these things have a show of wisdom. But this is not the wisdom from above. It is the wisdom of this world, and it doesn't work. These people who had supposedly come out of the world were now going back to the rudimentary elements of the world. And the wisdom was of Satan, the devil. James called it, or Paul called it, demonism. So Paul was writing to the people of God, to God's church, to warn them that they were heading back into the ways and traditions of this world. And these teachings were not God's wisdom that they were receiving. You know, brethren, that the best liars, of whom Satan and his demons belong, speak things which are almost true. You know, they appear on the surface to be correct, But there is deception, you see, in what is being said. And we must not allow ourselves to get caught up in such hypocrisy. In the courts of this land, for example, when a person is sworn in as a witness, such a person is asked the question, "Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?" Now, why do you think the courts are so meticulous in asking this question? It's always asked. And, of course, the answer is always, "I do." Well, I'll tell you why they're meticulous in it. Because mankind has come to understand very well the worldly approach to dealing with truth. And it is so easy for one to almost tell the truth about a matter, but by shading it just a little, the response comes as misleading. It becomes a lie. Something which has come to be known as a half-truth, or shading of the truth. This is not God's way, brethren. You know, He says, "Let your yea be yea and your nay be nay." Be honest in your answers. But it is the way of this world. It is the way of Satan and the devil and the demons. Satan is the father of lies, the father of confusion. Now, our God is not a God of confusion. When God speaks, He speaks truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. But, brethren, mankind often wants to appear to be this way, and yet they demonstrate in their actions deceitfulness. Look at 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 14. And verse 33, it says, "For God is not the author of confusion. He's the author of peace, as in all the churches of the saints." Now, we are in a church of God's saints. Are we this way? Can our word be counted as true? Can people trust what we say? Look at verse 40. It says, let all things be done decently and in order. See, this is the way God is. It has to become our way. We need to think about how we're coming along with this. Our God is a God of order. He has established laws and statutes and judgments whereby you and I are to live our lives the way things ought to be done. God has established a plan whereby His purpose is to be fulfilled. We're able to see, for example, the order of this organized approach of God as we study, for example, the creation. All that God has made, He made it perfect, complete, as it was intended to be by Him at the time of creation, to the extent that God intended it to be that way. Now, God expects to see improvement and growth, but He left many things in a state such that He expects to see our involvement, but according to His will. There was order in the way things were to meet God's expectations for you and for me. For example, God began with order relative to time. Think about it. There was 24 hours in a day. There were 7 days in a week. Approximately 52 weeks in a year. We can count on it. We know what it is. God established the seventh day in each week as a special day, as we heard in the opening prayer. Holy to Him. He called that day the Sabbath. And he gave instruction as how he expected his day, the Sabbath, to be observed. Look at Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. Thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. And on the seventh day God ended his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work in which he had done. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. By observing this day as God has instructed, we honor him as our creator. Now, if we were to change the day or to observe it contrary to God's instructions, which there are plenty of instructions in this book concerning this day, then we reject him as our creator and as our God. It's that simple. You know, why don't you and I keep the first day of the week? Most of the world does. We don't do it because we know this would not be pleasing to our God. Most of us did it in the past. But once we learned that that isn't what God wanted, we changed what we were doing. Yet Satan has tricked the world into believing that it does not matter which day anyone worships God, as long as a person is consistent in what he is doing. God, in fact, would call such a practice rebellion. And so there is confusion in the world, even in how and when one is to worship the true God. And such confusion is of the wisdom of this world. Now, notice God's specific instruction on this subject in Exodus chapter 31. Exodus 31, and we'll begin in verse 13. He says, "Speak also to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbaths you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you." When we keep this day in honor of our God, it shows that we understand who God is and that it is he who sanctifies us and sets us apart as holy for his use. "You shall keep the Sabbath, therefore, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death, for whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people." And it's just like we heard in the announcements concerning that, the Q&A. This is a true statement, and yet people break the Sabbath and they don't die. And they say, it doesn't really mean that. But they don't understand what he's saying, do they? That it's not talking about the first death, but the second death, the eternal death. I mean, it's given for all to die once. "Work shall be done for 6 days, but the seventh is the Sabbath of rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. Therefore, the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign. A sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed." It's pretty plain. There's no question as to God's intent and purpose relative to his Sabbath, and yet the wisdom of this world does not accept this plain instruction from their Creator. One source I read made this statement: "This is the only one of 10 commandments not repeated, not to be repeated, after the day of Pentecost. This source continues, and it's the Ryrie Study Bible. It says the church made Sunday her day to worship. And it uses Acts 20 and verse 7 as its the basis for its tradition, commemorating, they say, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But where did the church receive that authority for such a change? The church that changed this. Well, I can tell you where they got it. They got it from the God of this world. They got it from the wisdom of this world. Satan, the devil, inspired it. And we see once again the wisdom of the world raising its ugly head. Leviticus 23 lists all of God's Sabbaths. These are all a part of an important doctrine, an important commandment of our God. We do all understand what the word commandment signifies, don't we? It does not portend anyone, substituting a different instruction in replacement of God's spoken or written word, solely on the wisdom of this world. But this is what happened. God established his holy days around which our lives are to be regulated, both weekly and annually. God's holy days are the framework of God's plan. We consider these days in planning our weekly and yearly activities. Let's turn to Leviticus 23. Let's read verses 1 through 3. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feast of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts." They belong to God. He never changed them. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, a holy convocation. You shall do no work on it. It is the Sabbath of the Lord in all your dwellings. Now, the observance of this day reflects two main things. That God is our creator. He created the world in 6 days, and he rested on the seventh day. Now, to substitute any other day for this day would not properly reflect God's purpose in the Sabbath. That's easy to understand. Try to explain it to a friend in the world. The other significant point of this is that it reflects a special relationship between God and the person who is observing the day. It shows who God's people are. God's annual feast days, which have been appointed by him to be observed at specific times, it's all listed here in this chapter. We won't try to read all of that. Each has its own specific purpose. You know, God doesn't do things, brethren, without a purpose. And so we have the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. We have Pentecost, trumpets, atonement, tabernacles, the last great day. God's days. No man or church or any organization has any authority to change any of them. They're God's holy days. He's never changed them. He established them, and they still are in existence today. Each established by the eternal for a specific purpose in explaining the plan of God. Most of the world doesn't understand that plan because they don't understand the holy days. Each of us has to make a choice in regard to these days. Will I or will I not choose to obey God in these days? Now, the wisdom of this world cannot change God's command or his perfect law. And if I do not observe these days as instructed, God says I commit sin. Now, we organize our lives, brethren, based upon God's holy days. I remember when I came into the church and first understood these days. You know, it wasn't easy to convert what I was doing to what I had to do. And I knew I had to do it once I proved it. And Satan, by tricking this world into changing the days they observe, has changed the entire approach which mankind has taken in living their lives before God. And whatever is being done in the world today in relation to observing their feast days, they are contrary to God's instructions. And God calls that sin. Of course, when one is called of God and is given knowledge of His truth, that person will have to adjust his approach to how he directs his life. You know that it's true. And as you all know, this can create problems for someone or anyone as he or she strives to obey God. Now, all of this will change as far as the problems once Christ returns to the earth and establishes the kingdom, because everyone's going to keep these days. But these type of problems then will be eliminated. We look forward to that time. But in the meantime, see, we have to be diligent in following the commandments of our God ourselves. We can be very encouraged by the writing of the prophet Zechariah regarding the Feast of Tabernacles, for example, in Zechariah chapter 14. Zechariah 14, verses 16 through 19. The prophecy says, "It shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that which ever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, on them will be no rain. And if a family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague which the Lord strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all nations in the world that do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." All peoples of the earth will know then, brethren, the true way of God. They will learn to keep God's Sabbaths and His holy days, because they will be penalties. And these won't be penalties that are promised for the future. They will be penalties now. And they will learn to keep God's Sabbath in His holy days, and they will be blessed for their obedience to God's commandments. And paganism will eventually be totally wiped out from the face of the earth. That's going to take time. But why does God require a central location for observance of the Feast of Tabernacles? Why does He tell His people to not forsake the assembling of themselves together on His Sabbath? God has provided such that different feast sites can be established, which He says He places His name there once the ministry makes that determination of where it will be. But they're not to forsake their assembling together, for example, on the Sabbath. Why should one, if at all humanly possible, not stay home, for example, on the Sabbath day, attempting to observe God's day in the privacy of his own home and even the feasts? Well, as we noted, God has a purpose for what He commands of us. And by our observance of these commands, we learn of God and of His way. Now, following God's instruction, that enables one to realize that we are a part of something much bigger, much larger than self. Our calling is much more than merely seeking personal salvation, brethren. It develops within us a sense of mission and a sense of something which is of tremendous value and which is eternal. It connects us all together as a family, a part of one another, not a selfish approach to a way of life, but an approach of giving and of sharing, which is reflective of God's way of life. An approach which gives proper order to what we have been called to be a part of. Plus, it has the effect of unifying us all to God's holy purpose. Now, when we see God's people coming together and understand that this is something huge, which we are party to, we are able to visualize a family. The family of God. All pulling together for one great purpose. I've mentioned this in the past, but the first time I went to the feast was down at Jekyll Island. There were about 7,000 people. And I'd never been to anything like that before, where everyone was of one mind, as far as I could tell. And they were all seeking one purpose. And they were observing the feast in accordance with God's instructions, and it was joyous. And it was a wonderful time. And I always look forward to that since. And I still do. Even with our numbers smaller. When we all attend the feast together, we form an eternal bond, brethren, through the Spirit of God, which cannot be easily broken. If one desires to destroy the unity of God's people, his first aim would be to remove the Feast of Tabernacles. And then all of God's other holy days. Or to create counterfeit days and call them holy to God. And this is what Satan did with his Sunday worship and his pagan holidays. And the world loves it. Try to talk them out of it. Try to explain God's truth to them. You'll find yourself in deep trouble. Remember that Judah lasted as a nation longer than did Israel. You ever wonder why? You probably know. Judah continued to keep God's holy days, and Israel did not. Let's review this story. Turn back to 2 Kings. Second Kings chapter 10. Second 10 verse 11, we'll begin there. 2 Kings 10 and verse 11 says, "So Jehu killed all who remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, and all his great men and his close acquaintances and his priests, until he left none remaining." Now, he did this because God told him to do it. Remember that Jehu was the son of Jehoshaphat, and God had made Jehu king over Israel. And you can read of this back in 2 Kings chapter 9 and verse 3. We drop down to verse 31, and we'll read to the end of the chapter. It says, "But Jehu took no heed to walk in the law of the Lord God of Israel with all his heart. For he did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, who had made Israel sin. In those days the Lord began to cut off parts of Israel. And Hazael conquered them in all the territory of Israel, from the Jordan eastward, all the land of Gilead, Gad, Reuben, and Manasseh, from Aroer, which is by the river Arnon, including Gilead and Bashan. Now the rest of the acts of Jehu, all that he did and all his might, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? So Jehu rested with his fathers, and they buried him in Samaria, and then Jehoahaz, his son, reigned in his place. And the period that Jehu reigned over Israel in Samaria was 28 years. Once Jehu began removing the people away from the laws of God, which is what he did, and God's holy days, he began substituting days. And he began removing God began removing the kingdom from Jehu. You see, there's no inconsistency in what God will do. When an individual or a group of individuals begin rejecting God, then God rejects them. Notice the example of Solomon back in 1 Kings chapter 1. 1 Kings chapter 11. 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 1 through 11. But King Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh. Women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites, from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, "You shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you, for surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods." Solomon clung to these in love. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. For it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not fully follow the Lord, as did his father David. And then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So he just got into all this, supporting all of them. So the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart was turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. God had appeared before Solomon twice, and yet here he was doing these things. And had commanded him concerning this thing that he should not go after other gods, but he did not keep what the Lord had commanded. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, "Because you have done this, and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant." Remember, brethren, God's holy days are a part of the statutes of God, which he commanded to be observed forever. Solomon should not have done this, what he was doing. Verse 12, "Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days," God said, "for the sake of your father David, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen." Now drop down to verse 28 and we'll read through verse 38. The man Jeroboam was a mighty man of valor. And Solomon, seeing that the young man was industrious, made him the officer over all the labor force of the house of Joseph. Now it happened after that, when Jeroboam went out to Jerusalem, that the prophet Ahijah, the Shilonite, met him on the way, and he had clothed himself with a new garment, and the two were alone in the field. And Ahijah took hold of the new garment that was on him and tore it into 12 pieces. And he said to Jeroboam, take for yourself 10 pieces. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will tear the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and will give 10 tribes to you. But he shall have one tribe for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem and the city which I have chosen out of all the tribes. Because they have forsaken me and worshipped Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Milcom, the god of the people of Ammon, and have not walked in my ways to do what is right in my eyes and keep my statutes and my judgments as did his father David. However, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand because I have made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of my servant David, whom I chose, because he kept my commandments and my statutes. It's very important, brethren, that we continue to observe God's judgments, his statutes, his commandments. And when we don't do it, we know what's going to happen. We've seen it. But I will take the kingdom out of his son's hand and give it to you. 10 tribes. And to his son I will give one tribe, that my servant David may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city which I've chosen for myself to put my name there. So I will take you, and you shall reign over all the heart your heart desires, and you shall be king over Israel. And then it shall be, if you heed, notice, if you heed all that I command you, walk in my ways and do what is right in my sight, to keep my statutes and my commandments, as my servant David did, then I will be with you and build for you an enduring house, as I built for David, and will give Israel to you. What a promise. But what did he do? We see Solomon's punishment for his disobedience to God's way. Now, Rehoboam succeeds his father as king, but it's not going to last long. Let's go over to chapter 12 and verse 4. He's speaking here to Rehoboam. Your father made our yoke heavy. The people have come here now. Now, therefore, lighten the burdensome service of your father in his heavy yoke which he put on us, and we will serve you. That's what the people said to him. So he said to them, depart for 3 days, then come back to me. And the people departed. And then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who stood before his father, Solomon, while he still lived. And he said, how do you advise me to answer these people? And they spoke to him, saying, if you will be a servant to these people today and serve them and answer them and speak good words to them, then they will be your servants forever. But he rejected the counsel which the elders gave him and consulted with the young men who had grown up with him, who stood before him. So after Rehoboam took the kingdom and began to rule, he rejects the counsel of the older wise men, and he consults with the young men that he had grown up with, who now stood before him. Does this have a familiar ring? Interesting. God inspired Solomon to write, there is nothing new under the sun, in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 9. Let's continue here in 1 Kings 12, verse 9, it says, and he said to them, what counsel do you give? How should we answer this people who have spoken to me, saying, lighten the yoke which your father put on us? He's talking now to the young guys that he grew up with. Then the young men who had grown up with him spoke to him, saying, thus you shall speak to this people who have spoken to you, saying, your father made our yoke heavy, but you make it lighter on us. Thus you shall say to them, my little finger shall be thicker than my father's waist. I'll crush you, is what he said. And now, whereas my father had laid a heavy yoke on you, I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips. I will chastise you with scourges. So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam the third day, as the king directed, saying, come back to me the third day. Then the king answered the people roughly and rejected the counsel which the elders had given him. And he spoke to them according to the counsel of the young men, saying, my father made your yoke heavy, and I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips. I will chastise you with scourges. So the king did not listen to the people, for the turn of affairs was from the Lord, that he should fulfill his word, which the Lord had spoken to Ahijah the Shilonite, to Jeroboam the son of Nebat. Now when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, saying, what portion do we have in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now, see to your own house, O David. So Israel departed to their tents, but Rehoboam reigned over the children of Israel who dwelt in the cities of Judah. So, after Rehoboam had made the decision to rule the nation harshly, Jeroboam ruled against Rehoboam and rebelled against Rehoboam and took rule over the 10 tribes. Israel, it says, returned to their tents, and Jeroboam became the king. Now, Jeroboam, brethren, had the potential to accomplish great things with Israel, which God had charged him to do. But then what does Rehoboam do? Let's look in verse 26 and 27 of chapter 12. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. He's looking out for himself. He's not trusting in what God told him. God said, I will establish you if you will follow me. But what does he do? So with this selfish regard for his own skin, in his own position, Jeroboam made a decision. God had told him, follow me, and I will establish you. But what did he do? He feared the people that they would return to Rehoboam. And being politically astute, we've seen a lot of that, and a practitioner of situation ethics, Jeroboam turns from obedience to God and his ways in hopes of protecting what he thought was already his. It was his as long as he obeyed God. Verse 28. Therefore the king took counsel and made two calves of gold and said to the people, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Jerusalem, which brought you up from the land of Egypt. And he set up one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Now, this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. And he made shrines on the high places and made priests from every class of people who were not of the sons of Levi. He rejected God's rulership over him. Big mistake. Verse 32. Jeroboam ordered a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did at Bethel sacrificing, so he did at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made. And at Bethel he installed the priests of the high places which he had made. And so he made offerings on the altar which he had made at Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month which he had devised in his own heart. And he ordained a feast for the children of Israel and offered sacrifices on the altar of burned incense. He changed the days that people were to observe based on God's command. And he established his own feast days. But he called these days the feast of the Lord. They were in fact the feast of the God of this world. The same feast that people keep today in the world. History of the family of man, brethren, continually repeats itself. In trying to protect his position, Jeroboam established new centers for worship. He replaced the Levites. He did away with the Feast of Tabernacles and with other commands of God. Now, this took time. It didn't happen overnight. It may have taken months. It could have taken years. We understand that. We've seen it. It took time. Think back to our own experience. Notice the human reasoning behind all of this. In verse 28, what did it say? Therefore the king took counsel and made two calves of gold and said to the people, "It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods." This is how idolatry begins, brethren. See, the plan is to make things easier for the people so they'll love you, right? But brethren, it doesn't really make things easier. And things just appear to be easier on the surface. God's way is truly always the easiest way. Christ said in Matthew 11, verses 28 through 30, "My yoke is easy and my burden is light." But we've got to trust God. And God will bless us when we do. There's no rest in this world's ways. There's no peace in this world's ways. Look around you. Observe the results of the world's ways. We see it every day. Jeroboam was a politician. What does he do? He establishes a place of worship other than Jerusalem. He doesn't want the people associating themselves with the place God had established. He tells them, "Jerusalem's too far. You can't do that. You can't go that far. And you don't need to. So you can worship God from anywhere you want to be. You don't have to be in church on the Sabbath day. Worship God at home." So he established Bethel. Now, why did he use Bethel? Let's go back to the book of Genesis and observe Jacob's encounter with God. Genesis chapter 28. You did say I had the rest of the afternoon, right? I'm kidding. Genesis 28 and begin in verse 10. Now Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran. So he came to a certain place and stayed there all night because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place and put it at his head, and he lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed a dream, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached to heaven, and there were angels of God ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, "I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and to your descendants. Also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and the east, to the north and the south. And in you and in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. God tells Jacob, I am with you. Notice verse 19. And Jacob called the name of the place Bethel, but the name of the city had been Luz previously. Now, Jacob called this place Bethel. It was a place of honor. It was a place of respect. It was a holy place because God had been there. So Jeroboam, he looks back, he reaches back, and he sets up an altar at Bethel. He says, this will please the people. But God had commanded the people to go to Jerusalem at that time. Jeroboam was changing the commandment with no authority from God to do that. Look at Judges, chapter 18. Judges 18, verses 29 and 30. It says, they called the name of the city Dan after the name of Dan, their father, who was born to Israel, to Jacob. However, the name of the city formerly was Laish. Then the city of Dan set up for themselves, the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests of the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. Now this man that they're speaking of here was actually the grandson of Moses. And Jeroboam said to the people, look, Moses' grandson set up an altar in Dan. Why don't we do the same thing? That'd be nice. And we'll honor God that way. So all those people over near Dan, he set up that altar there. And this altar was set up to honor God and Moses. Now, carnally speaking, sounded pretty good. But God said, go to Jerusalem. But slowly, brethren, the people became weaned from God's truth. You remember the story of Jeremiah. God told him to go through the streets of Jerusalem to find one man who executed judgment and who sought after the truth. Jeremiah was unable to find such a person in all of Jerusalem. We've discussed the fact that people love being lied to. They like things the way they are. They don't want you telling them the truth. They don't want to hear the truth. Think about the holidays that are observed around the world today. Think about Sunday worship. The people love it. Don't try to change it. They will hate you. When Moses was up on the mountain receiving God's law, what was happening with God's people? Let's look back in Exodus chapter 32. Exodus 32, verses 1 through 6. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, come, make us gods that shall go before us. And as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And Aaron said to them, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. And then they said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. This is the God right here. So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. That wasn't a feast. He just said it. Tomorrow, we proclaim now this is going to be a feast. And then they rose up early the next day, burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. They loved it. The people became impatient, brethren, with Moses and with God. And so Aaron did these things, and the people loved it. And it was convenient. And they didn't have to worry about the truth. Don't confuse me with the truth. And so, that's what happened. Christ was killed. Why was Christ killed? Because he told the people the truth. And they didn't want to hear it. Brethren, if we do not remember but one point from this sermon today, remember this. You cannot mix God's truth with the wisdom of this world. God's truth and paganism do not mix. And if we do it, you cannot expect God to be pleased with it. It's unacceptable to Him. And what is happening in the world today, as far as religion is concerned, is unacceptable. We have to walk in all of God's ways, and we have to reject the ways of this world. Otherwise, Satan is making headway in his attack of our lives. We must not allow him, brethren, to do that. If you reject him, God says he will give you the strength to defeat him. But he continually will be on the attack against you. He wants to see you fall. He wants to see you go his way. And he will do all that he can to see that you do it. And so we have to stay alert to his devices, which you and I have come to understand. Let's do not fail, brethren, in this calling that we have.